Hey there, folks. This is Garrett and Riley back again, and this is an audio that we're doing for part of the EssoZone Codex Deluxe course in the forum. So you already know that if you're listening to this, but that's what it is. So
we're telling you anyway.
And telling you anyway. Now you can audio catalog it somewhere with the appropriate categorization scheme.
Wouldn't want to let this one get away. By the way, as you guys know, if you've already read the Codex and you've read my introduction, this is what was happening when I met Garrett for the first time. So I went over to his house in Eugene. I was living in Portland, Oregon, about 100 miles away. Was astonished that this guy on the DVDs, the Hyatt DVDs, lived near enough by that I could go say what's up. And he was putting on the EssoZone workshop at his house. So this is like the first interaction between us. So this has kind of a special place in my heart. And I'm excited to be coming back to it to talk about it, because it's been a couple years since we did that day. And
yeah.
This piece, this sequence, has had a lot of impact on a lot of people in the workshop context. And also people who have availed themselves of it through the website and are starting to teach the workshop on their own all over the world. So lots to talk about.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And hopefully this will help give people some ideas and things they can use to go deeper with the concepts when they're putting on the workshop, you know, kind of seed the pot, so to speak, so that when you conduct a workshop, you can at least give the questions some potential to devour different beliefs and give you more, a little bit more of a shock, and help you deliver that shock to the rest of the people who attend.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be taking what we say and repeating it at the workshop. But rather keeping these things in mind, learning as much as you can about them, thinking as much as you can about them, and then letting them fall away from your conscious mind as you go to greet the organic, living, breathing, undulating situation of the live workshop itself. And we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end, how to go about performing an actual workshop, some things you may have thought of, some things you may not have thought of.
Right, and we'll get into a lot more depth on that topic with another course in the next month or so, too. We'll be putting out a course on how to do a workshop, so from beginning to end, every detail covered. So, but for now, you can actually still do that with the EssoZone Codex. It's all there. It's all there, and you can make it work. All right. So I guess let's start out just with the few points at the beginning. We say keep in mind these key points while using the concepts and tools. And just so you guys all know, we're going to do discussion mostly based on the concepts there, but we'll also touch on the tools a little bit. So the concepts, the key points at the beginning are: the point here is to share knowledge and experiment with yourself and others. Stay with yourself. If you do it with others, stay with the group. It's more important to stay with the flow of your experience than it is to be right or compete. I said physiology is primal and ideas are secondary. Anything, that's pretty self-explanatory right there.
It's pretty self-explanatory, but that's a statement that you're going to want to keep coming back to, especially as you start to do practice sessions, even if you're standing in front of the mirror, imagining going through the workshop, especially with people, because you'll forget, probably. Your mind will want to take over and be like, oh, I have a little bit of anxiety, because you're probably going to have a little bit of anxiety, honestly, you know, even if it doesn't start until you open your mouth in front of the group. And then the mind's going to try to come to the rescue, like it always does, like, hey, I know what to do in this situation. Control it. So you'll want to really get that idea as second nature, so that when those thoughts come up, and they still do for me too, you can just gently push them aside and say, no, thank you, that's okay. I am anxious, but that will go away in a second, and I'm going to focus on the group and not force my ideas on what's happening.
Yeah. That's a good point to keep in mind. The second one is real brain and life change will almost always be accompanied by and or preceded by anxiety. Now, something I do want to say about real brain and life changes is those mean different things from different perspectives. And so I think a couple of years ago, my perspective might have been, you get in there and manipulate and change your life and your brain, you know, with these deliberate actions and all that kind of thing. And my point of view has shifted now to brain and life change aren't exactly a goal anymore from what I see from the place that I'm looking now. But instead, those may occur as a result of seeing more clearly, getting rid of the falseness in your life, that kind of thing. So it's more, if there's any deliberate action, it's to see through the false. And most of the rest of it now is just surrendering and letting go into life, which then there may be brain and life change, but it's more, there was some life change that occurred. It's not necessarily a desperate goal anymore.
Now the sort of the meta point there is being aware that you can communicate the same point through different metaphors. Brain change versus seeing more clearly versus whatever, whatever. And depending on your audience, you can send the message in a way that you think is going to reach them best. So if it's a bunch of people who've read Tim Leary and you happen to know they have, you might say brain change. Not that you have to be married to the metaphor, but just to sort of tickle their familiarity. Or if you're working with yoga people, you can sprinkle in a few buzzwords there. It's not manipulative. You're actually trying to get your message through in whatever way you can for those, again, particular people, not some ideal audience. Now, the point about anxiety, too, it's nothing to dwell on, but it's something to be aware of, not only for yourself, but as someone who's introducing this work to other people. I recently did a workshop with a friend of mine who's a yoga teacher, and we did a lot of undoing exercises, and the people in the workshop, most of them had never done anything like this before, and they were all having reactions, like they were supposed to, of course. And I just said very briefly at the end, if you experience any anxiety, that's fine, that's normal, it's just something going on under the surface. And as it turned out, one woman afterwards said that she was incredibly relieved that I had said that. Mm-hmm. Because she was having a the way she put it was, I didn't like those exercises, but I went really deep with them. And, you know, you never know what's going to come up for people. So you want to be sure that you can provide them with the assurance they need that they're not going nuts or probably more likely that they're not somehow doing it wrong. They might assume they're doing it wrong if they feel that.
And that brings up an interesting point, too, that most people have already decided what these so-called spiritual practices or body, you know, energy practices, the result is supposed to be. So right away you can tell the result is the expected result in that case would have been probably peace and serenity and relaxation or whatever. And really that's not, even though at times we've billed it that way because it does occur when you attack tension and things, in a way, that's a bit of a trick because in the short and long run, you're really looking at more anxiety and devastation than we could possibly communicate. But in a good way, because it's like, you know, the bullshit that we're all hanging on to, or the vomit getting washed away, or the sea of sewage, you know, somehow getting cleaned. Mm-hmm. And we're so used to the sewage that then when it's not there, we get a little bit afraid. And
it's true. It's true. And my experience is that even people who are not expecting that and who might have a reaction to a deeper, more intense work will be able to fall back on their own intuitive sense of what's happening if you just kind of gently make sure they know that that's okay.
Yeah.
And again, gently. So you don't want to manipulate their thought process and start to put them on edge. Like, you're going to be freaked out by this and you're going to wish you were, you're going to have tons of anxiety. But just like, if you notice someone having a reaction to say, accepting whatever's coming up, you know, if it's anxiety, fine. If it's joy, that's fine. Whatever it is, just accepting it. And that can often be enough.
The next point is a pretty simple one. I just mentioned there, powerful exercises. You will get results. Your results are your results. The other results of other people don't matter, except for sharing and discussion. No matter how much you learn about the taste of fine wine, you'll have experienced nothing until you taste it for yourself. So the main point there is just, you pretty much got to do this stuff or do whatever thing you're doing in your own life to have to get results, you know, to have your own experience of it. So
yeah, you've got to know these exercises inside and out through your own engagement with them before you introduce them to other people. I mean, it seems like too obvious to mention, but definitely.
The next one, do not approach this workshop with beliefs and preconceived ideas. Don't believe anything you read. Instead, do the experiments and get your results. Take what you get and don't take what you don't get.
Now, that's great, because so many of these are good tips for you, the listener. They're also really good tips that you can give to your participants in the workshop, you know, especially since this is going to be something new to a lot of people. Often I'll say something like, so we're going to go into some unfamiliar territory here for a lot of you, but I encourage you to take it as an experiment. Pay attention to how you feel, and hopefully you can leave with some new tools for your toolbox. You know, so there's not a lot at stake, but they know that, oh, I don't have to accept this. I can just try it and see what happens. It might seem very obvious, but not everybody out there who's teaching things at workshops has that attitude, and they can be very aggressive about putting their own idea and system onto people and be almost like proselytizing about their lineage or something. So you can put people at ease.
Yeah, if you get rid of the idea, if you get rid of your own beliefs and preconceived ideas about the Esozone workshop, that's a good place to start. So trying it out for yourself and getting rid of ideas of how it's supposed to go and beliefs about what it's going to do for you. And then from there, just experiencing it and leaving it at that. And then also being able to, when you put on a workshop, then you won't have the idea that it's supposed to go a certain way, and you won't have the belief that people have to have a certain experience or anything about it. If you put it on with that, if you really, really actually let go of the beliefs and ideas you have about it before you put it on, and about yourself especially, before you put it on, then no matter how it goes, it will go well for you, because you'll just be watching what happens and you won't be invested in it going a certain way. And right. So then by the end, you can just go, okay, I just did that. It's done. It's fine. It was good, you know, and move on. Instead of holding it up to some kind of idea of how it's supposed to go. Well, it needs to go this way. There needs to be this many people. There needs to be that much discussion and this much realization and that much exercise and all that kind of shit. You can just actually let it occur. I mean, you've already set up the stage so much by having the document, the ideas, the doing of the exercises, the gathering of the people. At that point, it's all downhill. You can just let it roll. You know, have an idea of how it's supposed to go.
Exactly. And with that attitude, you can't lose. So you're taking on the same attitude that you're encouraging in your students from the point of view of your practice as a teacher. So you're saying, well, I'm experimenting with playing this role and doing this workshop, and you'll get tons of information back. if you want to label it as good or bad, you know, feel free, but don't take it too seriously. Just collect data.
That was something interesting they brought up in the free hypnosis course we took.
Oh, yeah.
Was that a good hypnotist knows... Oh, spilled my coffee on me. Good hypnotist knows all the time that he's just getting more feedback. So whereas a so-called ineffective hypnotist might be getting upset because the person isn't going into trancing exactly the way he imagined, the so-called effective hypnotist would be just observing whatever occurs and knowing that it's all part of the hypnotic process.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not ever going to be thinking he's unsuccessful. He's always successful. It's just gathering more information.
Yeah, and the idea there is not just to give him or her a boost or protect their self-esteem, but it makes them much more likely then to find what actually is going to be the next step to help this particular person and all their uniqueness get into that trance.
Exactly, yeah. And so that takes all the expectation and desire for certain results out of it. Then you're able to actually get somewhere. And that can be the same with a lot of science. A lot of times people are motivated by the funding of the study and the maintaining the orthodox opinion of whatever professors they're working with and academia, and then the peers who review the peer-reviewed journals and the pressure from that. By the time we get to a study, often it's colored by expectations of what the results will be. And a lot of times studies lose funding when the expectations aren't met. So
mm-hmm.
we see it built into a lot of science, a place where people like to pretend that there's some kind of objective thing going on. There really is no objective thing going on there at all. But a person could open up more into actually checking out what results are occurring instead of having ideas about what's supposed to happen ahead of time and then measuring everything based on those ideas.
Mm-hmm. Martial arts, again, is a really good place where you have to focus on what's actually happening, because when there's actually a fist coming at your face, you know, you're not going to do a perfect crane kick like you practiced a million times. You're going to have to do whatever deals with that particular fist coming at you. Now, those of you listening, you may be interested in checking out that free hypnosis course. If you just Google Hypnosis Motivation Institute.
HMI,
there's a free course, and you'll be certified as a hypnotist. And you can actually learn a lot from the point of view of the hypnotist that you can apply as a teacher or leader of workshops. Get inside their heads a little bit.
And it does take a decent amount of work to do that course. I was actually surprised that if you not only watch the course videos, of which there were many, you also have to do a bunch of practice stuff in between and actually really learn something.
There's a final exam too. So it's not it's real stuff. They're not just, you know, giving you a stopwatch and putting you out on the street.
Yeah. We mixed it with undoing a couple times, which is a nice, maybe we could do a course on hypnosis and do all the different hypnosis sequences and then actually show the arm raising induction. So if you're listening to this and that piques your interest, feel free to drop us a line. But yeah, we mixed it with undoing in the way that Hyatt talked about. If you recall, I did that with a couple people, and I put them into the hypnotic trance first and then had them lay down and do the exercises. And I noticed they just got a lot deeper into it and were more quiet throughout the entire session. And I had them get back up into the chair and back into the hypnosis and then back out again at the end. And it was rather interesting. Anyway, that's just all a side note or a digression here. But so folks, we'll get deeper into those experiences in another course.
It does apply, though, in the sense that as you're putting people in a heightened state of vulnerability, their nervous system through these exercises, you're in a position to implant hypnotic suggestions as they're doing it. And I don't mean you will now bark like a dog, but simply observing, knowing enough of the mechanisms, when's a good time to say something and to drop in a line like I mentioned before, like accepting whatever's coming up, knowing that there's more at work than you realize now, knowing that it will have the impact that you would, so, stuff like that. And you can feel it out.
Totally. So this takes us to the concept zero, which is belches, farts, and yawns take precedence.
It's a great icebreaker.
Definitely.
I find I usually don't say that until somebody yawns, but somebody always yawns, or I yawn. And then I remember to say it, and it seems like a good time anyway, and it usually gets a few yucks and helps people feel more relaxed. And you can also observe who might get uptight, who still covers their mouth when they yawn, who's following your instructions, who's not. And that's not like them being rebellious or something, but some people, you know, will just have a sort of block that you, that might be surprising to you. You might think, why isn't this person doing what I said? But it's not about them versus you. It's just about them.
Indeed. So we mentioned a few things like that. Do you feel shame and guilt when you belch, fart, or yawn? And that getting in touch with those basic expressions and the muscle tension comes from repressing them. You're ready to feel and learn something new. And again, this isn't, I hear some critiques of the undoing work that it's just another technique or just another system or things that you have to do, a system you have to follow and believe in and all this kind of stuff. And I see the temptation to think of it that way. To lump it into those other categories. But the fascinating thing about it is like, it's kind of like a machine that already existed, and then you're taking apart the machine and letting out the little bird or whatever that's trapped in the center of it, you know, that's powering the whole thing. So if you imagine this machine with a bird trapped in the middle, a hawk trapped in the middle of it, and it's giving it all its life energy and doesn't know that it's anything but that machine. Let alone that it can fly and all these other things. Then someone comes, comes along and finds out they can take apart the machine and free that thing. That's the way I see the undoing in these exercises, is that you're more with all of a sudden waking up first to something that's already going on. It's like, oh, there's this whole trap of muscle and emotion and beliefs that is completely enwrapped me, and so now I'm going to do things to take that apart, to remove that as much as possible. So to me, it's not so much a doing, it's a taking apart and then letting go more and more into the process, which appears impossible when the tensions and the emotions are still there.
When you still identify with them.
Right, exactly. So that's what I mean about you get in touch with the muscle tension and the repressing of certain things and let them free. Yeah, there are techniques to this, but seeing as how you're doing them with your own body and then the purpose and the direction behind them is to break apart that machine, the structures that are there that aren't you.
Yeah, another way to look at it might be, oh, you want to cross a river? You're going to have to build a boat. Well, you're going to have to build a boat according to specific plans that will actually make it cross that river for you. Once you, once you get to the other side, you don't have to fall on your knees and worship the boat. Just leave it if you want. But it's not about that. Now, the other point here that hopefully you're considering as you hear this is that you, listener, as a potential and hopefully nearly actualized teacher of these techniques to people, you may have to field questions that are kind of aggressive and kind of defensive. And some people might just be motherfuckers a little bit about it and sort of poke at it. People who haven't done it before, especially people who might have a real entrenched idea about themselves, either in other practices that they do or just in general, and they may feel that these exercises pose a threat. Of course, people will say things when they haven't even done any of it, but then, you know, that's, you can deal with that in a different way, which is to say, well, you don't really know what you're talking about because you haven't done it, so give it a try. So you're going to have to find ways to try to get through those critiques. I hesitate to say critiques because they're not critiques, they're just reactions, without becoming emotional or defensive or like, well, I'm doing really good and you're just reacting, you know. You don't want to get in that battle. So you can just say, well, here's another way to look at it. Like, I see what you're saying, but you're missing this other thing.
Yeah. All right, so concept number one, we're skipping over tool zero. We have a little bit of a video about that. It's just learning how to learn, and it's in a way learning how to think. How to think for yourself and to actually dig through and process some information. But you can follow that and explore that on your own. Concept number one, what the hell is going on here?
I don't know.
That's often the answer, yeah. I really don't know. I mean, and there's ways to look at this. You can look at it as one of the layers is, okay, so for us right now, one of the layers is we're on Skype recording this conversation. We have the PDF out in the computer. Another layer is like each of us is in a room somewhere, you know, in a town somewhere. You can think of it in a number of different ways. Or my body is doing certain things. I'm toying with something, fidgeting with some case for some headphones. I mean, there's some basic levels of it, but then there's a deeper level too, is like where does this fit in a greater pattern in our lives? You know, where does this particular experience, how does it fit in?
Yeah, or the sort of the feeling of wonder when you go, oh, I've actually been kind of taking it for granted for a really long time consistently that I exist.
Yeah.
And existing is fucking weird. It's unexplained. It's just there. And if you can sort of get people in a room into that state of mind where they're realizing that, oh, whoa, you know, they'll be appreciative of that. They'll also sort of begin to resonate with each other. They'll start to feel the group coalescing because they're all experiencing suddenly this room in this different way. And there's a sort of brotherhood and sisterhood of not knowing what the fuck is going on.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing for people to stop and notice. And especially if they're feeling, it can be a great thing to realize in the middle of being upset about something, or being, you know, complaining and that sort of thing, and then going, what the hell is going on? Oh my God, like, forgot I was fucking alive, you know, for a long time. Yeah, how long has it been? And then coming into that and being able to stay in that for a while. Ideally, and, you know, stay in it all the time. But it's going to take a number of times of falling into it before that'll happen. Yeah, so that one is something you can take with you and use all the time. And it's funny because I remember coming up with the question years ago for use in a Tales of the Post-Apocalyptic Thief book that I was working on, and that was his central philosophy, was that question, and then later put it into the Creative Deconstruction blog, and then into the 10-part email workshop, and then found it in the Jed books, like stated exactly the same way.
That's right. I'm actually glad you said that, because I was going to ask you, when I reread that, I saw that, I was like, is that where you came up with that phrase from? But no, I didn't think it was. I love philosophies that are in question form too.
Yeah.
Now here's an important point, guys. And this comes from my experience both teaching in the university context, where there's a lot more just talking, and also with the undoing. Keep an eye out for this. When you are leading a group and you want them to talk, you're leading a discussion, and you ask a question and you want responses, allow time after you ask the question for people to consider it and for them to venture a response. There's such a tendency, I've noticed in myself and almost everyone who hasn't been at it for a while, to want to rush through the silence because you think, oh, this is an uncomfortable silence and I'm in charge, so I need to do something about it, so I'm going to say something and kind of force it. Meanwhile, from their point of view, they were just kind of thinking, considering it, and allowing a little bit of time for it to percolate. So really hold down that space of it's okay for there to be some silence. People are just thinking. You can encourage them some more to speak. You can even be a little bit out front about it. Like I often say, if there's a long silence, I'll say something like, well, I know each one of you is thinking something right now. Which one of you wants to share it? You know? And don't take no for an answer.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people are probably just nervous naturally and waiting for someone to really kind of almost make them say what they really would rather say but are too anxious to say.
What are you guys, stupid or what?
Yeah. Without being... So that's a good example of you want to be firm, but you don't want to be... like aggressive towards them. You don't want to be triggered by what's going on in the room, take it personally, and then take it out on them somehow. I've seen that happen. Yeah. And it's always really weird. So even if you do feel uncomfortable, just say, yeah, I feel uncomfortable, that's fine. That's natural. You don't have to react to it. And just remember, they came to you for someone to tell them what to do for a little while. You're telling them what to do. That's why they're paying you. So be firm in that role.
Yeah, and it's just a role. So when you ask yourself what the hell's going on here, even in those situations, you can just look at it and it suddenly is not... It's not your deal. It's all you... But the problems that you might find in it aren't yours. They're no one has problems, really. Those are just ways of looking at things. So, like the other night, I was out at a friend's house, and they had a fire going, and everybody was chilling, and it was a nice time. And then I felt really in touch with myself, and somebody else showed up. And somehow I decided, I don't know why, I didn't even decide it, but I got up and walked away into the moonlight. And everything was really chill for a while there. And then as soon as I was far enough away to not be a part of the conversation anymore, people were like arguing and kind of fighting with each other. And I noticed it, and then I just had the motivation to continue staying away from it. But it was really interesting to note, like, well, I was there when it was chill, and then somehow I just drifted on from it effortlessly, and then I noticed it got all like heated and all these things, and everyone seemed deeply involved and in it for some reason, like there was something huge at stake. And I noticed my reaction to it didn't change. I still felt like it was just a cool night and there was a nice fire and there was noises around it, just like there were before. And it just let it pass on its own. So when I asked what the hell's going on here, it just kind of, everything became simple and easy. It wasn't like, oh, I better get over there and try and solve something. It was more, it's just fine how it is now. It was fine how it was before.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, that perspective works nicely with the idea of playing the role in the workshop, too, because you can also be totally transparent about that role, you know, and even joking about it. When I did this workshop with my friend Aaron, we didn't really plan it. He was going to go first with some yoga, then I was going to do some stuff, then he would do some stuff, then I would do some stuff. And so after we introduced ourselves, and it worked out beautifully, just flowing with it like that. And we just kind of looked at each other like, well. And then Aaron just goes, well, what should we do? And he turns to the group and he says, any of you guys want to lead the workshop? And it was just such a cool moment because it took it took the whole pressure off the idea of us being in a role. Like it just put like, yeah, this is just a role. But it also legitimized that role because each of them had to think for a moment, well, hell no, I couldn't do that. You know, so that's a nice balance too. Transparency, it's a role, but it's totally a role that I'm playing right now.
Yeah. All right, so now concept number two is it's okay when things don't go well.
Oh, yeah, good one. Good one. This is another one like that first comment. Well, all of these really, but that you'll just want to remind yourself of again and again and again and again. Because the fact is, things don't even go wrong very often, but you're going to think they're going wrong pretty often. Most likely, you're going to think things are going wrong when they're not, right, if you're just getting into this. Because you may not be used to standing in front of a room and leading people and just even seeing what that looks like and being in that role. So there are going to be a lot of new sensations and observations and looks on people's faces. And you're going to think, what's that look? Why are they making that look? Is that about me? I think the best way to deal with that is to invoke this idea and say, well, I don't know if they are. I could think about it forever and I wouldn't know. So why not just say, so what if they are? If they are doing the worst thing that I can imagine, that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting because some of these concepts, and I don't want anyone to take them as a belief or a truth so much as an exploration, because if you say it's okay when things don't go well, the interesting assumption underneath it is it's possible for things to not go well, which you can discover that it's not possible for things to go wrong, and that wrong is only a judgment call or an interpretation of something that's actually happening. So there's no real foundation from which to say something is going wrong, but this concept will help you get to that place.
It's true, because there is a part of you that will operate on the right wrong thing for a while, and you just need to really gently but repeatedly remind it that it's not really useful anymore.
Yeah, another way to word it might be, even when things seem to be going wrong, they're going perfectly. You know, you could phrase it in a different way, and it's saying the same thing.
Yeah. If you can walk into that room with the attitude that there's no way for things to go wrong, that whatever happens is fine, you're going to be unstoppable, and you're going to lead a really great workshop.
Exactly. So there's that. And then we get into the Atlas Shrugged tool, which is, you know, shrugging off some of those worries. And so practice that for yourself. The concept three, you are the most important person in your life.
Wow. Well, so here's another one where it's, you know, this one isn't so much for you while you're up there leading the workshop. I mean, it's for you, it's for everybody. But what it really, it's kind of a gift, another gift that you're giving them to invoke this idea. And like the what the hell is going on here thing, you can guide them into a mental space that's pretty rare and that they'll associate with the work and kind of anchor in the work and that they'll feel a resonance with each other for, because this is something that is too rarely acknowledged. We're all pretty clearly the most important people in our lives. It's pretty freaking clear. But we're constantly bombarded with messages that say, that's wrong. You should be more concerned about the starving people in Africa. Why can't you be more like the Dalai Lama? Isn't he the, you know, the best-selling author? So you're giving people some insight into a new way of seeing things that's probably going to come as a relief to a lot of them. But even the ones who it comes as a relief to may resist it at first.
Yeah, there's a lot of resistance to that one, I've noticed, in some people. Generally, people who have families will tend to say, no, my daughter is the most important person, or no, my son, or my husband, or my whatever, my grandma, whoever it is.
Uh-huh. My.
Exactly. Right? So it all comes back to the self anyway, because it's the only way you can know anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know that it's possible to know anything else besides the self, or whatever that is, or one's own perception. So yeah, that's a nice way to get people back to square one of like, oh, all those things I was wrapped up in aren't what's at stake. It's me here perceiving and living. That's what I've got, and that's all I've ever had.
Now, the sort of soft option on this one, I guess, is to talk about the idea of introjects. And so that if people are really resisting, you can say something like, well, how many of you guys feel guilty from time to time? And say, well, what's the voice of that guilt? Like, is that someone in your life? Is that someone you've known? Do you have people in your head that you know criticizing you, telling you to do things that you hope will applaud when you do something right? The answer is always yes. You say, well, those aren't the real people. Those are your images of those people. And they're bullying you around inside your head. And so you need to be firm with them and say, no, I am the most important person here, within my mind. And then once you banish those, you realize, well, there's just what's surrounding me physically right now anyway, so I don't need to be concerned about so-and-so until I'm actually there with them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always a way, there's always a place that you can take things, depending on the response that you get, instead of just hammering the same thing, hoping that the wall will eventually come down. You can find ways to climb over it or around it, depending on the situation. That's why it's really important to think through these concepts on your own and have a real, solid, personal understanding of them, so that you can draw from that.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the important part, is listening to this and getting into these concepts on your own enough to where you can trust where it's going to go with the group and be in tune with what people are experiencing. And again, for you, for someone conducting the workshop too, that concept can be really important. Like just paying attention to yourself while you do it. Watching what's going on and witnessing how you're moving and what you're believing about yourself and all the different aspects of it, just watching from an impartial standpoint, stepping back from it a few notches and seeing yourself clearly while you put it on. So that, again, it's about you. It's not even about all the other people there. It's still about you and your experience. There just happen to be some other folks around observing it, but
That's a really great point too. Again, to invoke the example of my recent workshop with Aaron, we afterwards were kind of laughing about it and saying, like, isn't that funny that this time when we were hanging out, there were other people there who paid us and who also did what we told them to.
Yeah.
And if you have that attitude while you're doing it, you just feel like these people are your guests.
Yeah, exactly. And that's primarily what they're there for anyway. So we move into concept number 4, the cognitive endgame.
Endgame.
So what would this concept, again, we're looking at it originally from the perspective of, I want to be in control of everything that's happening in my life, now to a perspective of, I want to let go, I want to surrender to what my life is, I want to undo the false and fall into the what's actually there, the organic. And so from that new perspective, the end game might be a little different. So this is something you would use when you don't have time to do the body work, or you don't have the desire to do the body work, but you recognize something you're doing or experiencing is something you don't want to have go on anymore. Now, one thing you could do is do the end game on the desire for something to stop. You know what I mean? You could do the end game on the part of your mind that's categorizing what you're experiencing as bad.
Meta end game.
So you would essentially use it. You want to bring whatever's going on into your awareness. Try and notice if it's a pattern or a repeated thing that you've experienced. And then use the powers of your mind to cut through the false parts of that situation enough so that you can actually let go for real from whatever it is you're clinging onto that's producing that experience.
This is a great one to do in the bathroom right before your workshop, right after you throw up your lunch. It truly is good to implement. Because when, as the teacher here, you are continuing your own work. This is still your own work that you're doing. And if you remember that and treat it in the same way that you would an undoing session for yourself, which is to say, if discomfort arises, you expect it. That's no problem, but it's coming up to be cleared. And if you bring that same attitude to your practice of presenting it to other people, you will not only probably do a much better job of it, but you'll also get a lot more out of it for yourself in terms of your own practice. And you can also use this as another little one of those idea gifts that you're giving to participants. You know, just the idea, if you can convince them, maybe if it's not happening right now for them, you can convince them that even if it's not, at any moment, really, theoretically, at any moment, you could drop any habit, any belief, any behavior. You can just drop it. It's just that you're not dropping it yet.
And the way that's going to occur too, yes, through seeing it clearly and seeing how false it actually is. Because if you see it and still think it's valuable and you need it, then chances of you letting it go are very small. But if you use the process of the end game like a sword, so the main goal of it would always be to cut through and see clearly and undo the falseness of whatever game it is that you were playing. And so using it in that way, like a sword or like a something to cut apart those thoughts or those structures, then you'll actually be able to let it go. Just like a costume you were wearing, if you cut it in half, it would fall off of you. Before that, it might have been, you know, pretty attached.
So notice also the things that Garrett just said to communicate this concept to you. First, he gave an example. Well, first he just described it, of course. Then he gave an example of how it might look in one particular case. And then he made an analogy about it. So coming at it from several fronts, you can do the same thing with the people you're working with. It's usually very helpful to have an example. And you can even use, again, your example of I did this before the workshop because I had anxiety. You know, people really appreciate that kind of thing. And it helps take the load off you. And then any sort of other figurative way to communicate the idea, like the sword metaphor, but we'll leave you to your own ingenium to do that.
Exactly. So there you have the cognitive end game. Explore it, play with it, see what it does for you. The next concept, number 5, is either all communication is hypnosis or none of it is.
So for this one, you've got to know what it means. In order to bring it up, in order mm-hmm. to really bring it up. You can't just kind of skirt over it and hope that the fact that you can pronounce the words will convince the people in the audience that you know what you're talking about, because it won't reach them. Here again, very useful to do that HMI course. Also very useful to use what's going on in that moment as an example of the concept. So you can say, well, look, I've been telling you guys to do things in this first, 20 minutes, half hour of the thing. And you've been doing it. I've been giving you commands, and you've been carrying them out. What's behind that? What's the difference between that and hypnosis? What's the difference between your first grade teacher telling you what to do and hypnosis? Now, what are all the different outcomes? Are there outcomes that you want? What were the outcomes of your first grade hypnosis, of your employment hypnosis, of your SO Zone workshop hypnosis? You know, and that can really help open things up. And that's a good phrase to keep in mind. When you ask these questions, you're not looking for an answer, and you're not trying to guide people into an answer. You're opening the question up. And people should leave probably feeling like they know less than when they came. That's good. That means they're thinking.
Exactly, yes. Yes, no less than when you started, then you're doing well. You're on your way. Mm-hmm. All right. Exercise or concept number 6, the ambiance administrator. Now, I rethought this one a lot lately. After this restructuring or deconstruction of my former perspective, again, this used to be one where I would think of it in terms of control or exerting control and manipulation on a situation, saying, oh, you can be in charge in any situation you find yourself in. You can come in and infuse it with whatever emotional content you want and get what you want out of it. And then you can use that as a trick to, if you're feeling bad, you can act in a certain way to infuse a situation with joy. And then that will feed back into your brain chemicals and then you'll experience joy. So in a way, you trick yourself back into it. Now, from the perspective of wanting to break free of the false and paying attention to what's actually going on, then the ambiance administrator is a little bit different. It's more about paying attention to what's actually going on and noticing that you're having reactions or you're carrying a certain state around with you and then getting rid of that state, seeing through that state. And so instead of creating an emotional experience of joy or happiness, which you can do with this concept, instead you would try and get free of all the emotional entrapments. So notice what's there and then notice that it has no actual content in reality except for in your own mind or in other people's minds. And then from there, getting to a state of, just like with the what the hell is going on here, getting to the state of, oh wow, I actually exist and this is totally mind-blowing. So in that way, you will then be experiencing what some have called true joy. And what they mean by that is an unbroken experience of enjoyment and playfulness while witnessing just the bare facts of being alive instead of feeling emotional exaltation. So it's not so much a state of consciousness, but a state of awareness.
Mm-hmm. Now, from the point of view of the workshop, you are responsible for getting people engaged with what's happening. And from that point of view, you are the ambiance administrator in the sense that if you expect people to be interested and excited about what's going on, you need to be. You need to model that. They are looking to you. Now, that doesn't mean you got to walk in like, hey, guys, I'm so stoked to be here. Let's get going. But
you can do that if you want.
You could do that if you want. But there does need to be a genuine engagement, a genuine engagement. And people recognize when there is and when there's not. And they will become engaged if they see you truly engaged. And this goes for so many of the other concepts we've talked about before. as you're communicating them, you can kind of be modeling them. Also with the exercises, especially exercises that may have a little bit of resistance in a lot of people, like making sounds or the laughing, people might kind of start out like, ha, 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 ha. But if you're there going, no, it goes like this, ha, 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 and you just keep doing that, they'll entrain with you, and they'll start doing it too. And even when they're like, you know, you put, just put more of yourself into it as you're walking around, and that'll be contagious. They need a leader. They need someone to do it, show them how to do it, and show them how to do it to the degree of engagement that's necessary to really make their practice work and the workshop work, and for it to be enjoyable for everybody and something that they really remember.
Yeah, the ambiance administrator is great for that, and then also just to notice how you infect and inject yourself into different situations, and you might suddenly notice that you were creating some uncomfortable state with certain beliefs and certain emotions that you would use to create that, say every time you go to work or every time you get around a certain person. And you might blame the other person for you having a bad time of it, when in reality you can recognize you're infusing. So one way the ambiance administrator is to see through the lie of otherness on the level of how you're experiencing reality. Because you can take full responsibility for it and go, okay, I'm infusing each situation with its own mental contents, and I'm interpreting it in that way, and then believing it to be an external circumstance that's happening to me. So in a way, you can see the ambiance administrator as a way to stop doing that and to go, no, what's happening is just what's happening. And if I stop judging it and putting it into categories and breaking it up into right and wrong and good and bad, comfortable and uncomfortable, then I can just fall into the actual experience, in which there's no need to judge or categorize or anything. So one way is to use the ambiance administrator to stop doing it, and then the other way is to use it deliberately to create situations for your own, you know, for your own fun or profit or both.
They also notice how interwoven a lot of these concepts are, and how there really is a deep coherence to this workshop as an artifact. And you want to make sure to bring that out when you're going through it, so people feel like this is a thing, not just a bunch of little things tacked together, but there is a theme. Not that you have to say, here's the theme, but that there's a connection between all of these different points, and it feels like a whole composition.
Yes. Concept number 7, always ask for what you want.
Yeah.
And this is, you. And again, you can keep using these concepts from all the different perspectives, and what I mean by that is, as you undo and cut through the false in your life, the concepts are going to change for you what they can do. But they seem to be able to go pretty far in bringing things to awareness and then helping you to cut away the unnecessary and cut through emotion and cut through thoughts and ideas and beliefs you have about things. So always ask for what you want. In the beginning, you might use that just externally with other people. You might, even by putting on the workshop, you're going to decide to ask people for a certain amount of money and to do certain things. But then also, like I called for my phone bill, I'm calling these people, you know, once a month or so and getting rid of certain charges on there. And I just ask for it. And most often, no one's ever called and asked for these things before. So then they just start figuring out ways to do it. So instead of asking someone, there's ways to ask for what you want that are more effective and less effective. You know, instead of asking someone, is it possible for me to get this room? Instead, you could ask, how can we come up with an arrangement right now?
That, you know? My grandmother always says, don't ask in a way where they can say no.
Exactly. And they still might say no, but that, you know, you can increase your chances. And it's not so much about whether they say yes or no, it's about getting into that habit. And then you can start asking that of yourself and of your experience. And hopefully the question will be something like, how can I see through? How can I see more clearly? How can I get in touch with what's actually going on? How can I get rid of all the falseness I perceive in my life? Asking for those things of yourself, putting your mind to work on those instead of, you know, fear-based desires and that kind of thing. So you might start out with fear-based desires, and once you start getting what you want, you realize none of it's very satisfying. It's all based on alleviating this fear or that fear, even if it seems like a good thing at the time. And then once you cut through that, you can say, how can I move through and be done with this fear? How can I stop struggling? How can I surrender to my own life? Mm-hmm. How can I live in the flow that I know is there but don't always see? So there's some ways to really use that question, to use that concept.
And those layers, Garrett, that you talk about how these concepts will transform for you through your practice, that's something to keep in mind too. The concept might mean something different for you at your stage in the practice than it will for the people that you're talking to in the room. And you don't need to try to drag them to wherever you are. You want to try to meet them where they are with the concept. So if it seems like you're just going to confuse people by talking about it on too advanced a level, you can keep it on the immediate. You know, again, it's about feeling it out.
Now, it's, and let each person kind of chime in, let the people chime in about the concept, you know, like they might, and at the end of the thing in the codex itself, it says, if you do this in a group, brainstorm together some of the ways you can apply this concept in your lives.
Yeah, yeah. And you can, it's also good to, like, you can initiate it by saying, like, okay, everybody, just think of a time when you really, you wanted something from somebody, but you were too afraid to ask for it.
Yep.
They'll come up with something, and then it'll be personal. And then it'll be practical and more useful for them, too.
Exactly, yes, it will.
And you can make sure also to mention that it's okay if the person says no when you ask. That's fine.
And it's okay if it don't go well, right?
Yeah, and it's okay for you to say no to someone else. That doesn't mean that you're dissuading them from asking for what they want. So that's one way that this concept could be misunderstood by people just beginning to grapple with it.
So the final concept in the regular part of the workshop, and we'll get into the taboo tools and concepts shortly for a little bit. The concept 8 is the Command Z advanced work. So we kind of use that as a catch-all for everything you can do and any way, directions you can go. Once you kind of have that basic foundation of the concepts and the tools down, there generally people all of a sudden have new desires and new directions that they want or need to take in their lives. And so basically the Command Z advanced work is there as a natural and organic continuation from that place. So you want to get deeper into getting rid of the muscle tensions, emotional entanglements, and falseness in your life, and you want to know how to do that. So that's something Riley and I had to discover on our own and forge and create on our own, and so now it's a little bit easier for us to say, okay, you're ready for the next step, here it is. Here's some ways you can take it without having to search for too long.
Now, in that advanced work includes radical undoing sessions, full-on sessions. Now notice that in the Esozone Codex, if you know the undoing work somewhat well, there's none of the real lying down, breathing position, digging deep, radical undoing session type work. Okay? That's important to notice. You're becoming qualified to teach the techniques in the codex. If you want to provide sessions for people eventually, that's a whole other thing. And that's more advanced work that you will have to do to be able to provide that to other people competently. But then eventually, if you go down that road, you can provide that as a next step for the people who are working with you.
Yep, and then from there it deepens too. The second one on the list is dredging the shadow sessions. Now these are, once you've already had a lot of experience with the warm-ups and the stuff in the codex, and then a lot of experience with the stuff, the actual undoing, work enough to where you understand sequencing and understand a lot, have a direct experience with some of the exercises and then some of the things that arise in the sense and feel sessions, the dredging the shadow takes that to a deeper level where the roots of certain beliefs and interpretations of your own life and the elements in it come out, get drawn into light, and then are able to shrivel up and you're able to move on from them. So dredging the shadow is a little more advanced beyond just the regular radical undoing session. And then to learn how to conduct those, that's going to be a whole nother thing. I mean, that alone, how to conduct dredging the shadow, could take a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
Getting to the point where you'll feel comfortable with the flow, even of going through a session for yourself, and then being able to guide someone else and being okay with what comes up.
And it's good to realize, too, lest you become overwhelmed, that even if you're not at all versed in the radical undoing, dredging the shadow stuff, as long as you're putting sincere effort into your own engagement with the Esso's own material, the important thing is that you know more than the people you're teaching, and therefore you can teach them what you know. Don't try to teach them what you don't know, but also don't feel bad that you're not teaching them what you don't know.
Just one thing at a time. So in the third part, customized training programs and consultations. We've got a few of you involved in that now. Mainly that's just some people do 2 sessions a month. Some do 4 sessions plus weekly consultations. Basically, we just work with each individual to develop a training program that meets their needs. So getting involved in that can go any direction. You can get into doing workshops, get into doing the undoing work, get into starting some other business, or just get deeper with your own undoing practice and that kind of thing. So it's just individual stuff, and it's a way we can go further than we can with just the classes and whatnot. And now with the Inner Circle and the Forum, we can have another place for that training to take place. Number 4, Spirit of the Entrepreneur sessions. That one's pretty basic. Most of it's getting over the fear and the overwhelm of thinking you need all these certain things to go right for you to do a business. So we kind of cut through that and then bring an idea or two through a process of seeing if it's going to work at all or if it has potential to work, and then helping you see very clearly what you need to do to get started and to make your first few dollars at it, which is actually a lot closer and more simple than you might think.
And especially if you're doing the workshop and you make a few bucks on it, you might start thinking, wait a minute, what am I doing? What have I ever been doing? Working jobs that I don't like. You know, once you get a taste for it, it's like getting a taste for blood. You have a hunger for it. Once you realize that you can do something that you love, that you were going to do anyway, that actually provides an opportunity for you to do what you love in a more expansive way than otherwise you would, and you're generating income from it, that's hard to go back. So those sessions help you go forward instead.
Yeah. Number 5, weekend retreats in California or in your, or Portland or in your own city or town. Those are things we are setting up with individuals people are volunteering to come and visit with us. I've had a couple so far. So you guys are always welcome to come and work with us directly, and we generally can make the time and the space for that. But then in the future, we're going to want to have some inner circle retreats and some bigger and more involved experiences if that's something people want. So more of a major retreat experience is possible. We're going to definitely charge a lot for it, spend a lot on it, and make it pretty much the most memorable time you've ever had. You can trust us on that one. So just stay tuned and always, you know, speak up if that's something you're interested in. But we're looking there at sort of a $5,000 range for making it the way that we would like, for doing it justice, the getting us all together, flying all over the world. We want to make it something valuable in the extreme, so you don't have to do it over and over. And that by doing that, making that investment, you really come out of it as something different than you came in. And luxury is one nice way to do that. And then the sixth one is organic initiation. Now, of course, we still have the URL hanging around. And
this is a work in progress.
Yes.
And those of you interested will get in touch. We can leave it at that for now.
Yeah, that's going to be its own thing. Let's call that the top tier.
Yeah, that's the no limit experience.
Right. And you'll feel it right now if it's something that you're going to do. So if you know that, then communicate that with us, and we'll see if you really know it and go from there.
All right.
So that was concept eight, just the advanced offerings, and hopefully you see how that fits in. Now, the following addendum, which we haven't got into much and didn't cover in most of the workshops, you can choose to add these if you want, is the taboo tools and concepts. So the taboo tools are the gag reflex, which is one of the more powerful things you can do with your own body, and strangely, one of the more taboo things you could do with your own body. I mean, try doing it anywhere in public and see how far you get. I'm just gagging myself. Vomit up some of the concepts I'm believing in. See how that rolls for a bunch of people.
So this one is obviously hard to do in a workshop setting because you don't want to risk people throwing up all over the studio that you're renting or whatever. And a lot of people might be unduly resistant to it. You can leave it up to your discretion to what degree you want to mention or hint at these taboo elements in the workshop. It can be very effective to simply hint at another layer that they're not receiving.
You could even do the gag reflex yourself and demonstrate it and have them watch with your shirt off how it actually works, and then just say, but do that on your own, you know, and you'll have to experiment if you want to. But just remember, everybody, it's your own body, so there's nothing wrong with anything you could possibly do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to notice, it's actually more weird that there's ideas against doing something with your own body than it is to do something with your own body.
Definitely.
To me, the strangest part of it is that there's actually some kind of resistance against exploring your own body. That to me is far more psychotic and strange than anything I could ever do with my body.
There are also elements like that. It's not outside the realm of possibility that you'll have someone at your workshop who had or even has an eating disorder, and they might have a totally different relationship to the gag reflex and linked to much more direct trauma, which is all just to say, you know, don't be too forceful, like, you have to do these things.
What's interesting about that is that sometimes the bulimia, the drive in that comes from or relates to the gag reflex alleviating great amounts of tension. Now, in their case, the tension might be built up from their ideas about eating and their own body image and things. But the tension is relieved by the vomiting in that case.
I think the same is probably also true to a degree of binge and purge alcoholics.
Yeah.
What else can we say about the gag reflex? It's a great way to jumpstart your morning.
Yeah, just try it out for yourself. It's nice. It's a nice experience.
Better than a cup of coffee.
So taboo tool number two, screaming or yelling. Generally, you do this into a pillow, but it's nice at a workshop to do it with a full group out loud.
Yeah, it can be really nice. When I was doing this last workshop, we ended with doing a lot of laughing and crying and then a great huge yell, and people had huge releases, and we had been doing a lot of sound oriented stuff. It was a voice oriented workshop. At the end, we come out and there was a massage therapist in session in the studio in the room next door. We didn't realize that there was any massage happening that day, and they were cool about it, but they were dealing with the sound the whole time, which is just to say, like, I don't regret it or anything. We couldn't have not done that. It was billed as a cathartic voice workshop. And it is a shared space, but just be aware of the space that you're using and who might be around.
There's an interesting component of that is the screaming out loud will, just the thought of that exercise and reason why it's a taboo tool is that just by considering yelling or screaming, you will immediately come up against whatever your limitations are in your where you live or where you're practicing. And so if you're in a downtown area full of people, you could probably scream and get away with it, but people are definitely going to notice and react. Mm-hmm. And in your own house too. Like if I did it right now, I think it's fine. But certain times of the night, it won't be as fine. It will cause a whole series of things to occur, you know, all of which would be interesting to observe, but, not necessary. Just thinking of the concept itself can show you how you're living and what restrictions you have around you.
Yeah. And that's another thing to keep in mind as you decide whether to do this in the workshop or not. You've got to be the person that's in charge here. So that means you're probably going to have to be the first person to really let her rip and start yelling.
Yeah.
And to really keep going, to keep them into it. You'll also have to stop them once they start, which can sometimes be more of a task. No, it's not. You just have to yell stop loud enough for them to hear. And you are also the person who's going to be talking to or dealing with anyone in the surrounding area who's made uncomfortable by it. So that means that if you're cool playing that role, even if you're in like a public park and you're comfortable with people coming up to you, say, people might even be into it.
But you have the power of the group on your side there too. Yeah,
that's true.
Doing it at once, so no one's going to think there's a lone nut, you know, screaming away.
Right, but you've got to be totally comfortable with it.
Yeah, or even if you're not comfortable with it, just be willing to go through it.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So here's the last few things, the taboo concepts, which you can sprinkle in if you feel so inclined. Taboo concept number one, words are more real than reality to most people.
What does that mean?
So to give some examples of it would be that a real extreme example is a report about some concentration camp victims was that some people who died the fastest and became distraught the fastest were people who had really illustrious titles like PhDs, heads of companies, people with a massive amount of titles that kept them separated in their minds from other people. When they were put into these camps and stripped of their titles and their roles right away, some of them died almost instantly and just lost any will to live because they were so identified with the titles that they formerly had and what those titles meant in the world. Another place you can see it is in the names of states, names of countries, names of cities, and then the subsequent borders. None of those are real in any sense that you can experience, except for in the minds of other people. So if there's a border and there's a country name and enough people believe in that, then they will do things to make it seem real. So put up a box and a line and a fence and then say, this is where, you know, in politics surrounding it and decisions about it and all these things. Those are all built on words, on labels, on concepts, not on some reality. If you watch animals, they fly, like we talked about borders before, they fly over the border, no problem.
So this concept is something that you may choose to introduce to the group if it feels appropriate, but it's certainly at least something for you to keep in mind as you lead the workshop, which is to be keeping in mind that for these people, words are more real than the reality. Probably. And you can take advantage of that, you know, especially when you introduce yourself. You can, well, we talked about putting people at ease, but you can also describe your experience in such a way that makes them more comfortable with you. You know, you can even say, I you know, trained with Riley and Garrett and Garrett trained with Doug, or whatever you want to say that's going to make them comfortable with you. That's more real than the reality of the situation to them. And the reality of the situation is that you're just a bunch of people standing in a room.
Yeah, and nobody knows what's actually going on. We're all like, you know, lost in life, and it's a great and vast and dark mystery. We're here trying to, you know, put some space between us and that fact, that realization. So you can decide if you want to take the ship into the, you know, the Bermuda Triangle, so to speak, or if you want to just have a nice, you know, coastal cruise.
Right, right. The other thing to keep in mind about workshops and teaching in general is that very often, most of the time, you're not going to get in everything that you wanted to get in the time allotted. Things tend to go long. So these things at the end are good to have in your back pocket if you want to sprinkle them in, but not things to feel like you must jam in. It's better to just let things, if you get to the end and it feels like the end and the time's over, to just let them go rather than, oh, by the way, here are a few things real fast, and confuse people on the way out.
Yeah. So the taboo concept number two, escape from false ideas about yourself. And they're all false.
Again, this one's probably more for you than for them. To really dig into this one, you would need to probably devote a certain amount of time to it. You could do it in a variety of ways. You could have a more focused group discussion. People could generate false ideas about themselves that they know they have and then examine in the context of the group. If you're working with someone directly, it's much easier. But this one's good for you to keep in mind that any idea you have about yourself is false. So if we've talked already about if the workshop doesn't go, quote, well, what if the workshop is going, quote, well? Well, don't get attached to that either, because that's just the other side of the same coin, and the pendulum will swing back eventually.
And any ideas we have about ourselves, yeah, they are just... It's just dross. It's not, there's no basis for those ideas in any kind of reality at all.
There's not a lot to say about that one, is there?
There's not. At my core, real fast from that concept, I can see why it's taboo. Just straight to the fucking big black hole at the center with that one. So yeah.
That's the concept that makes it totally irrelevant to talk about anything.
So taboo concept number three, enjoy everything. There are no troubles. Now, why on earth would this one be taboo?
Well, because we're a masochistic culture and a slave culture that has been conditioned through our upbringing to betray the very rhythms of our natural being so that we can be useful in a mechanistic industrial process that has the benefit of institutions and not humans in mind.
That just so happens to still go with the flow of everything anyway.
Yeah.
But then we like to conceptualize. The thing is, I've brought this up to so many people. I think I spent about a year or two with this at the forefront and pretty much reduced most of my friendships down to zero at some point, because I noticed that my own former identity and then everyone I knew, their identity also was built on some huge structure of problems and troubles. And like, they were so defined by that they and myself were just see where the problems were this time when we'd meet up, you know. Oh, well, how's today? Not so bad. Like, why would we ever say not bad, you know? Well, not bad.
People will fight with you, too, if you try to cheer them up. Say, don't you know that my trouble is real and important to me? You're trying to save me from my trouble is an affront to the seriousness of my situation. It's kind of dismal. So that's something to keep in mind, too. Another reason you might want to be careful about bringing something like this up in the workshop, that you might get a lot of defensiveness coming out. But there are always ways to bring these kinds of things up and then completely reduce the tension right afterwards. I think of like Bill Hicks and his act. Sometimes he'd go on a rant, sort of like the one that I just went on about, you know, how horrible things really are. And then he looks around and he goes, oh, sorry, wrong meeting. and so he gets the idea across and then immediately cuts through any tension that might have built up. So you can do that. You can totally play around.
Yeah. If you're at all bold, I mean, you can. The thing is, the concept of it's okay when things don't go well should have freed you up by now to be able to just go ahead and introduce all the taboo concepts and see what happens. Because, like, part of the joy of this whole experience for me, and I think for you, Riley, is also watching what actually happens when we just throw it all out there. You know, like, we have so many great experiences of trying to talk about these things with people that it's like, nowhere else can you get such an absurd show, you know? Like, nowhere else can you get such clarity on the falseness all around.
It's true.
By actually just introducing them anyway. And like how we got someone telling us we're doing modern day exorcisms and releasing demons into the house, you know, at the place we're doing Undoing. Like, where else can you get that classic? Classic experience, I mean.
Well, yeah. So then I guess the caveat would be this, like with the screaming. If you're going to bring up the taboo subjects, just make sure that you're able to stand your ground with them and you're not going to get super flustered if you get a big response.
Exactly. So that's it for the Esozone Codex concepts, some of those latter tools there. And folks, we got all kinds of videos for you. And a bunch of extra stuff on the board, so just have a look around and enjoy the course. And as always, write in if you want to see or hear anything else.
Yeah, we covered a lot of stuff that took us years to learn, that hopefully it won't take you years to learn, partially because of that. It's a pleasure to talk about these things in detail. We've never really sat down and done that.
No.
And it's bringing me back to the old days.
Cool.
So, good stuff. Yeah, good luck, everybody. Questions, always welcome. Comments, always welcome. We'll see you in the forum.
How long was that one?
That was like an hour 45.